Hello and welcome to this week's edition of The Front Page. We're just coming off the back of one of the busiest weeks of the summer, and on today's show we'll be reviewing all the big stories from Goodwood and beyond, as well as some of the stories which went a little bit under the radar. Delighted to be joined in the studio by Matt Rennie. Welcome, Matt. How are you enjoying the summer?
Very much so, enjoying it now. It's nice to actually have some summer-like weather recently, and Goodwood was typically glorious this year. There's normally a day in it where it just bucketed it down, but
absolutely,
not this time around.
And it's very exposed up there on the downs when the wind sweeps in and the rain is pouring, but when the sun is shining, what a wonderful place.
It was spectacular. I was only watching it on TV, but it was nice to watch it even in some sunshine in rural Yorkshire for once as well. But we were talking before, I don't know what the weather was like at Galway though. It seemed like it was a bit chillier over there in Ireland.
One of my abiding sort of mysteries of the week was seeing everyone wearing winter coats and flat caps and everything, and I'm not sure if that was a style choice or a weather choice or a little bit of both.
Who knows? It's Britain and Ireland. It turns within an instant, doesn't it?
Certainly does. And calling in from Deauville, Scott Burton, who is full of the joys of summer. You've been enjoying not just a racing recently, Scott?
No. I've been very lucky to get along to a few of the events at the Olympic Games in Paris as well. Fantastic atmosphere down there. It doesn't actually feel like the place I live, where normally everybody's very grumpy. Very, very international feeling. You run into Brazilians and Swedish volleyball fans in the supermarket and all the rest of it. It's just fantastic down there. And I hope everybody would agree. It looks great on the television as well. There's some spectacular venues. So we had a bit of racing here in Deauville as well. So all the best of everything.
Well, they certainly have made the most of that amazing urban landscape in Paris, just as Goodwood is so famous for its stunning setting. So the Paris Games has been a visual feast. And we might well return to the Olympics later in the show, but we're going to start with Goodwood, because, Matt, we had a very high-quality week. It was great on the course, great off the course. What was your highlight of the week? What do you think the big takeout story was?
Well, one of the biggest takeouts of the week, first of all, it was a shame that Rosalind didn't turn up for the typical duel on the downs we usually get every year with the top three-year-old milers and the older milers. For me, it was the Group 2 King George Qatar Stakes on the Friday. I was really taken by how brilliant the race was itself. It was a thrilling finish, you know, Big Ev's getting one over again on Asfer, and it probably gave more questions coming out of it than answers in an excited way to look forward to for the rest of the season. We know Asfer had the measure of Big Ev's in the King Charles III Stakes at Ascot. Big Ev's turns it over at Goodwood, and now they're going to hopefully meet up in the Nunthorpe Stakes again for that decisive rematch. And I know it was grouped all in name, but it was basically a Group 1 in running with the stars it had. And it was really nice that sometimes Goodwood, obviously it's 5 days, it's a long 5 days, but the fact we had such a star-studded sprint on that Friday prolonged that excitement and anticipation of the week rather than just coming towards a damp squib.
The sprinters get a pretty dismal reception in this country. Everyone slags off the lack of depth in the field. Asfura famously is somewhere around the 5,000th best sprinter in Australia. But it was a thrilling race. Big Ev's is a horse that's almost impossible not to love. Back to making all from the front, showing that electric pace and just holding off Asfura. Fantastic, teeing up for York beautifully. How do you see round three going?
Oh, I'm all over Asfura. I think she ran a stormer at Goodwood, and she comes out £6 better off when the two meet in the Nunthorpe Stakes. Big Ev's actually has to give her £1 when they meet at York later this month. And I really like her. I've developed a soft spot for her this summer because, you're right, I think people have been really unfair towards her. There's been a crabbing of the sprinter division in general this season, yet it's produced probably the best finishes we've had so far and the best contest. You know, the King Charles III Stakes was a great race. Obviously, the Queen Elizabeth Jubilee Stakes, Carden won it for the second year in a row. Might not be the best race, but a lovely story there. The July Cup was a thrilling finish again with Millstream, and now we've had the King George Qatar Stakes produced, you know, another fascinating rematch. So I think we need to put a bit more respect on the name of the horses in those divisions. Big Ev's, you know, wonderful horse. He's a bit of a ticking time bomb, isn't he? You go from the front and you can only hold out for 5 furlongs for as long as you can with him. But it's great, you know, in a way that we've also got this England-Australia old enemy rivalry taking place this summer as well. As I said to someone a few days ago, it's rarely I have a soft spot for an Australian, but Asfura is definitely one there. I think she's great. I think it's great that Henry Dwyer's come over and campaigned as aggressively as, he has done. He was even talking about in the aftermath of the King George Qatar Stakes, going to the Flying Five, potentially the Abbey and the Breeders' Cup as well. That's what you want to see from a global sprinter. It feels like we've had a bit of a dearth of that recently, where we're not willing to go on this global challenge. I remember the days of early 2000s, mid-2000s, late-2000s, when horses like Star Spangled Banner on the scene, Choisir was before my time, but coming over here and giving it a real go. So it feels like we've gone back to that way in a bit, and I think it does sort of deserve a bit more respect in a way. Those two have really lit up the sprinting division this year. Mm.
And speaking of big Evs, we have to touch on the incredible performance of Mick Appleby, who emerged as top trainer at Goodwood. He wasn't even priced up in most markets at the start of the week. Aidan O'Brien, hot favourite, and he just beat Aidan on countback on a superior number of seconds. What an achievement for Mick Appleby.
Oh, terrific. And you know, Mick probably was unfairly tarnished about 5 years ago as the best all-weather trainer in Britain. And since then, he won countless all-weather championship trainer titles. But he's built up a real formidable flat string now, really. And if you are looking to come into the sport as an owner, especially if you've got a sprinter, you're going to go to Mick Appleby probably, because he can get the best out of them on a consistent basis now. It's great, and I think in a way that's how Goodwood, glorious Goodwood works. The 5 days, it's not just complete top level racing. We have got the handicaps, we have got the nurseries, and we've got the maidens, and it gives trainers the chance, like Mick Appleby, the chance to really, put their mark against the bigger yards. But in saying that, he also had a Group 3 winner, and he had a horse finished third in the Molcombe as well. So he's got a real good team of juveniles coming up, and he's taking on the top trainers and getting the rewards as well. I think earlier on in the week, when we looked at the Goodwood Cup, the Sussex and the Nassau going to Coolmore and Godolphin, we thought it might be a similar outcome. But it's a great story, and it's really good for Britain and British racing, I think, as a whole. National Hunt racing, we saw that Willie Mullins is the monopoly. In flat, we're more used to Ballydoyle and Godolphin being the monopolies. So it's great that we've had a chance to be able to get someone else, someone new, to the top of the podium, really.
And that is the sort of beauty, or the curse, of Goodwood, depending on which way your money's gone. There are so many variables. It's a hard luck track. It does throw up surprises. But I guess not a massive surprise was notable speech winning in the Sussex, albeit pretty friendless in the market. And Henry Longfellow really was expected to do better than he did. Perhaps the ghost in the room was Rosalian, who didn't turn up, thus depriving us of the rematch between the two of them. What did you make of the Sussex? Was it a bounce back deformed by notable speech, or was it actually just a very soft race?
To an extent, I think it was a slightly softer race. I think the three-year-olds are still miles clear of the older horses at this stage. The litmus test will be Charon in the Jacques Le Marat this coming Sunday for the older horses. But watching the race back, I just feel it would have been set up perfectly for Rosalian for his, his blistering turn of foot on the outset. Yeah. It would have been Camford Cliffs 2010-esque for the Hannon team. And it was a real shame, and so unfortunate that he was ruled out. And he was thinking afterwards, well, where might we see this next rematch? It possibly won't be on British shores for this season anyway. It could be next season. Obviously, Richard spoke about wanting to keep Rosalian train as a four-year-old, and hopefully Godolphin keep notable speech and train as well. But now he's done his 2000 in Guineas and Sussex Stakes double first since Franco in 2011, which makes him a sort of an exciting stallion prospect. But the mile group one we've got left in Britain is the QE2 at the end of the season, where 9 times out of 10 you can put your bottom dollar on it that it's going to be soft ground. Rosalian likes fast ground, so who does notable speech in a way? It's probably going to be in the Breeders' Cup Mile that they next meet. So that'll be fascinating, obviously round a tight bend around Del Mar to see how it goes. But it's a shame that we're not going to see it on British soil again. Obviously, it was mitigating factors, really. I do think Rosalian would have won, though, and I do think he's the outstanding three-year-old this year by far. It's very disappointing to see Henry Longfellow. He's hard to get a mark on, really, and where he goes to win a Group 1 next, tries to win a Group 1 next, I don't particularly know. The Prix de Moulin, maybe, because it can turn up a bit weaker than some other Group 1s, but
yeah,
funny one.
Very disappointing by Henry Longfellow. I'm going to bring in Scott here, because one of the Coolmore horses who certainly wasn't disappointing, in fact, bounced back to fulfil some of the promise that Connections felt that she held was opera singer, who has now put herself very firmly in the mix for the ARC. Best price, but 10-1 now after her Nassau victory. Scott, what did you make of opera singer, and how do you rate her chances at Longchamp?
Oh, she's definitely a player, isn't she? It's interesting, Lee Moss had picked up in his colour. I think he was speaking to Michael Tabor and Aidan O'Brien after the race. But I remember going back to the Prix-Marcel Boussac on Arc Day last year when she was really, really impressive. And Aidan came into the press conference and basically repeated what Ryan Moore had said when he got off her, which is, we'll be back here winning the Arc with this filly next year. And it would be lovely to think that they really will now target that race. It's quite extraordinary to me that Aidan, for all the Group 1 brilliance and the races he's won around the world, has actually got a very moderate ARC record, apart from the historic performance of saddling the first three home in 2016, which I don't think any of us will ever see again. She's built for the race, really. She's a really physically imposing filly. She won't look out of place against the 3-year-old colts and the older horses as well. She's really built for the job. And she looks, when you see her in the paddock, she looks like the sort of filly that would actually enjoy a little bit of cut in the ground. It was very quick ground at Longchamp last year, and she handled it absolutely fine. It was obviously pretty rapid at Goodwood as well, but she just looks like she's been waiting for this step up in trip. She took the 10 furlongs actually absolutely fine, and I'd be pretty confident that she'll get a mile and a half as well. So she's a big player. Just going back very quickly to the Sussex, Notable Speech was obviously very, very good, and it was a good ride from William Buick, who knew the cutaway rail was coming. I just think going forward, Maljune ran a huge race. On the sectional times, he ran a faster time in three of the last four furlongs to the Notable Speech. But obviously, Tom Marquand was one further back behind Notable Speech and had to pull out wide coming around the rest of them. And the only furlong in the last half a mile where he was slower was in the final furlong. He was kind of paying for his efforts slightly. But I think with the blinkers, if they were to aim for the Prix de Moulin or something like that with him, I think he's a horse that's always looked like he might have a Group 1 day in him. And I thought that was a serious performance from him. And from that point of view, we should maybe not bag Notable Speech too much. You could say that the race obviously lacked Rosalian, but I thought it was a good performance. And he'd be carrying a little bit of my money next time.
And if you were taking a look at the ARC market right now, Scott, where would your money be going in that contest?
It's a bit boring to say the favourite, but Luc de Vega looked very, very good in the Prix de Jockey Club. He's going to be given this classic sort of French prep, put away for the summer, come back for the Prix Niel. He's only run three times. You know, is he streetwise enough? Well, he certainly looked it in the Jockey Club. Quite soft ground that day, so he won't mind it if it comes up soft. And I think we might be a bit of a throwback to I was going to say when you and I were growing up, but certainly when I was growing up in the sort of 90s, where the Prix Niel winner just then went and won the ARC. I think we might be looking at that kind of year. But there's many, many cards still to be played. I'm sure there'll be some good performances at York, and then Irish Champions Weekend and the trials. So plenty can change, yeah.
One filly that disappointed at Goodwood was Emily Upjohn, which meant that Kieran Schumacher's wait for a Group 1 victory for John Gosden goes on. What do we think about this, Matt? I was looking up his strike rate for John and Thady this season. He's 18% strike rate. The last time Frankie Dettori had over 100 rides in a season for John Gosden was 2022, when his strike rate was 20%, so very comparable there. However, Kieran's group class strike rate is just 2 from 38, 5%, whereas Dettori was actually operating at a higher strike rate at that level. Now, they're not directly comparable, and there's a huge dollop of luck that goes into it, and also the firepower you have to play. But there's obviously a narrative taking hold in some quarters that Schumacher is under pressure. How do you read it?
I think it's wrong this early to say someone's under pressure. It's almost going to a football analogy. We don't give managers enough time in football at clubs or whatever these days. People are so impatient for success, and some people want that in racing. They do want immediate success, but in a way, the Gosdens' top horses haven't really fired this season. Inspiral hasn't fired as of yet. Might do on Deauville on Sunday. Emily Upjohn hasn't fired. Is she still in love with the game? That's a serious question you need to ask now. Or is she just a difficult horse, but when she's on song, is brilliant. And I think it was sort of summed up really with Lead Artist winning the Thoroughbred Stakes for John and Thady and Kieran. It seems like the first half of the season was a bit one to forget. I think they've said it before, it's one where they didn't expect it to go as slowly as it has done, but hopefully it will pick up towards the end of the season. I think he could be a horse that could go through the grades in a way. He's been really impressive so far, bar like losing at Newmarket. So he could be one for the Joel Stakes and then a QE2 at the back end of the season. I just think the firepower isn't really firing in the Gosdens' yard at the moment. But as we know, the sport is swings and roundabouts, and it almost certainly will come round for a yard with fine trainers as they are. And I think they do need to stick with Kieran. I think he's a good guy. I think he's a good jockey, and he deserves the opportunity. And I think we need to give it at least two seasons before we start making judgments in a way. However, the speed in sport racing is, no one's patient enough for that.
Scott, how do you read it? I guess the challenge is any sportsman who is under pressure, the challenge is controlling it psychologically and ensuring that that does not then affect how you perform on the pitch.
Absolutely. From this point of view, I mean, you'd imagine that John Thady obviously trained together, but John is a very good kind of mind manager of his human staff, as it were. Anybody who managed to maintain a relationship with Dottori for as long as he did was very good at kind of managing his moods, if you like, and kind of keeping him away from the sort of weekly grind to just have him peak for the kind of really big weekend targets. I think that Matt's right. The problem is they haven't any three-year-olds. So they're basically, in terms of their big race chances, they've been relying on these handful of really proven older horses. Inspiral hasn't hit the target yet. Obviously, Kieran wasn't on Audience, which is the only real top-level group performer they've had so far this year. Rab Avlin's been on him in both times. So, but I think if you have a poor crop of three-year-olds, which they look to have certainly been slow to the party, shall we say, I think it's quite difficult for a stable like theirs to really make their mark. And John's been very good in speaking about him publicly two or three times this year. I'm sure he's trying to fill him up with confidence at home and saying it'll come, don't worry about it. The question will be how long the Gosdens owners keep faith with this rather than just saying, look, William Buick doesn't have a ride in this race, James Doyle doesn't have a ride in this race, or Ryan Moore doesn't have a ride in this race, and start trying to get them to go more sort of pick and mix for the big targets. We kind of saw it a little bit when the Gosdens had that falling out with Stradivarius and Nielsen with Dottori as well, and they took their kind of conscious uncoupling for a while, and the owner sentiment there was to get him back as quickly as possible. And I suppose from that point of view, it's as much about how John and Thady manage upwards as it is downwards, if you like.
Yeah. Very intriguing. That one's going to play out over the coming weeks and months. We're going to wrap up our Goodwood coverage there. But before we move on to our next stories, just a quick reminder, if you are watching this on August the 5th, you can get in today's Racing Post the big kickoff. It is the absolute pinnacle of football previews. It is jam-packed with punting insights from the best of our experts and a range of external experts as well. So if you're a football bettor or just a football fan, get out to the shops today, pick up your Racing Post, and you will get the big kickoff inside. There will be some options to purchase digitally as well over the coming days, and Members Club Ultimate subscribers get access to it via the digital newspaper, and you can find out more about Members Club now.
Get 50% off your first 3 months in the Racing Post Members Club. As a member, you get access to the digital newspaper exclusively available to members the night before. You'll get daily tips on the likes of Pricewise, Tom Siegel, Robbie Wilders and Paul Keighley. Enjoy award-winning journalism from the industry's best writers and watch replays from all British and Irish racing now available within the Racing Post app. Subscribe today and get 50% off your first 3 months membership.
Welcome back. We are now going to rattle through a few of the week's bigger stories in a rapid fire section. We're going to start with the latest in the Flutter and Arc Media race shenanigans, Matt. Basically, for those who are new to the story, what we've had over the last few weeks is a series of efforts by Flutter, who of course own Paddy Power, Sky Bet and Betfair, to try and make ARC, which is by fixtures the largest racecourse group in the UK, to come back to the table and renegotiate their media rights deal. Flutter say racing has got so expensive and turnover has declined in what is a declining product that they no longer make any money out of the sport. There's too much being charged by the racecourses, and they add that too little is making its way into prize money and promotion of the sport. Now, there's been a bit of back and forth here. ARC initially responded to Flutter's first efforts to not bet on a fixture with a legal letter, which caused a pretty rapid U-turn from Flutter. And they subsequently have tried some other techniques, which they obviously feel, I think rightly, that they are within the terms of their contract. And so initially, they were only betting to SP and only betting to SP 15 minutes before the race has started. But last week, at two ARC meetings on Skybet, they did not bet at all on the meetings and they simply streamed them live. So obviously feeling that streaming races, not betting on races, being the key thing. Now what they're trying to do here, I guess, is demonstrate to ARC that if they don't bet on the races, that they will see a decline in their revenues. And they're probably also experimenting internally. What is the impact if we don't cover all racing and in fact just offer our customers a subsection of the available action? What a difficult situation this is. No sign of this ending, Matt. And ultimately, obviously, customers of these firms are left in a situation fairly unsatisfactory that there's always a risk they're not going to be able to bet on some of the action.
Yeah, very much so. I think you said it's long and it seems like it's going to be quite a tiresome battle in a way, back and forth with two sides who aren't really willing to stand down currently and come together for the better of the sport in a way. Obviously, Sky Bet, as you said, no betting at all at Yarmouth and Bath last week. They're sort of, you said, testing the waters, pushing the parameters a little bit more to see what the impact is and making their point known. I think they are right in a way, given what we've been reporting on recently. And it almost leaves you playing a guessing game of where's it going to happen this week. I was looking through the cards on the Racing Post website yesterday thinking, all right, there's an ARC meeting there. There's another one at Yarmouth coming up on Wednesday where the highest winning prize is just over £4,700. You're thinking, well, that in this climate, in British racing, the pinnacle of global racing, as we love to call ourselves, that's not acceptable enough, really. It's not going to pay any training fees in a way and travel and costs. And you're thinking, well, that'll be the next meeting, cab off the ranks in a way. And it's just going to, this will rumble on for months and months before there's a solution coming. And it's just almost another unwanted battle clash in a climate where we've got no CEO of the BHA incoming as it stands. Joe Samaras-Smith, the chair of the BHA, is leaving next year. We've got so many senior positions to fill. It's just another roadblock in the way of trying to get the sport back on the motorway and in a seamless way. The ultimate loser is here is the horsemen in a way, trainers, owners, but mainly your ordinary punter. I know people that have only got Sky Bet's accounts and they're messaging last week going, Where's Bath on our cards? I want to have a little flutter. If you pardon the pun, obviously, but they're the ultimate losers. They're a backbone of our sport. Other punters, even if they're little punters, people might just have one account with Sky Bet or Paddy Power, and they're not able to place a bet on the horse racing, and they're sort of an unlucky pawn in a game from the elites here.
Well, I wonder if there's an outcome here that the ultimate lesson is that bookmakers don't need to offer all the racing, and that the position of racing will actually be weakened as a result. But let us move on to what you touched on there, which is about the leadership of the BHA. Julie Harrington is to leave her post as CEO by the end of the year. Joe Saunders-Smith will be standing down next year. They have been advertising for the chair first, so that's Joe Saunders-Smith's position. I understand that the purpose of that is that they want to have the incoming chair in place so that when they have a short list of candidates for the CEO job, the chair can make their decision. This, of course, is a very normal way of approaching it. You want to ensure that the chair and the CEO can work closely together, so you don't want to just impose a choice on them. On the chair, we've had lots of ex-politicians who are in the market for jobs, sniffing around, both Tory and Labour former MPs. We're told that none of the politicians have gone through, actually, and that the selection committee are looking for a chair with a commercial background. I can see the rationale of that. I think, you know, racing's challenges over the last few years have been principally regulatory. The changes to gambling regulation obviously had a huge impact on the sport, and links into government were extremely important. But looking ahead, we're perhaps now looking at a situation where racing is facing challenges around its strategy and how it's going to appeal to new fans. But as you say, you know, a huge amount of uncertainty right now. We're also missing leaders in senior positions elsewhere. And the next few months are going to be decisive, because these leaders are going to take racing into a really important cycle where some big decisions will need to be made and some big progress against some key challenges.
Yeah, it's not really going to be paddling in a stream once the new people come in. Mm. There's so many massive issues you've got to solve. Obviously, affordability checks, the levy reform as well, which it's just bitter at some points, really. Mm. I think it's very good. I think you have to applaud the BHA for not going through with politicians for these jobs, mainly because I think we need someone that's more politically neutral and from a business perspective who can bring that nous in. Hopefully they already have like racing. That would be a really good start for once, instead of bringing someone in
and to understand the sport as well, because it's such a complex sport, and if someone comes in without that knowledge,
and we haven't realized
that, they spend a year just getting up to speed.
Exactly, that we've not realized that before, and we need someone with a bit of knowledge in the sport to be able to hit the ground running, who is hopefully politically neutral, because we do have a new Labour government in charge. Whether people like it or not, they have the landslide. They've got the landslide. They've got the significant majority, and we need to work with them in a productive way rather than backing ourselves into a corner, which I think racing has done sometimes before. Obviously, the demographics of it is traditionally it's a conservative sport for the elites, but we have a chance now to give, not give an olive branch in a way, but to offer that arm of working relationship to make sure we come to bring resolution to the affordability checks and also levy reform as well, because we'll be in a dire state if not. And I said credit to the BHA. Politicians would not have worked, especially former Tory Conservative Party politicians, because it would just bring division in a way, antagonism against the government, and in some places a little bit of scandal joining the sport. And we really didn't need the name of that at the moment with racing. Mm. So it'll be interesting to see how it all plays out this time in 6 months, won't it?
So. It certainly will. I understand the chief executive position is going to be advertised this week as well. Stay tuned for the Racing Post. We will bring you coverage of that and any clues we get about what the sport is looking for. And now, Scott, I have to come to you. I promised you an opportunity for you to share some of your Olympic reflections. Of course, based in Paris, and so you have been privileged to enjoy some of the action in front of those iconic landmarks. What are your big takeaways of the Olympics, and indeed, what lessons do you derive from it that could be applied to other sports, including racing?
I just think the actual staging of it has been astonishing. You obviously, not everywhere has the kind of physical charms of Paris, but the way that it's been done, there's been full stadia everywhere. I was at the rugby at the Stade de France last week. I went to sea finals at the rowing. The swimming has been extraordinary. It's kind of swept the entire nation away with this phenomenon that is Léon Marchand. And also just the way that the crowds have been energized, but they've also been kind of informed as well. Obviously, we're not all experts in fencing or judo or whatever, and the way that they've had kind of dual language MCs, and they've employed an expert in the field in the French language, but who's also there to kind of rev up the crowd a little bit, and then a British or an American or an Australian sort of co-commentator to pick up the slack in English and really kind of brief the crowd on the personality involved. It was at the team show jumping final, which Great Britain won on Friday at Versailles, which is there and then. I mean, that's one of the three top tourist destinations in Europe, probably. And you've got this fantastic temporary arena looking back up the park to the Palace of Versailles. The way that they've kind of blended this kind of information on course, it makes me think about racing, where we do have some excellent kind of on-course MCs and commentators, but the way that you can really sort of bring the public along with you, not just in terms of getting them to sing the Marseillaise or old Johnny Halliday songs, but to really engage them and inform them about what's going on. I thought that again, at the show jumping, that the British commentator there was excellent. There's an American who works for World Aquatics who really brought the swimming to life as well. So that, and combined with the actual Sonny Lumiere, if you like, the light shows and all the rest of it. I don't know if you saw the 100 metres final last night, but the sight from above the stadium of the lights going out and the kind of lasers and people's phones and all the rest of it, it was like being at a rock concert almost, and then you get these fantastic performances on top of it. So it's been fantastic from that point of view. Paris or Parisians have maybe quite fairly got a reputation for being a little bit grumpy, a little bit self-absorbed. And obviously France is not in a happy place at the moment. We actually don't technically have a government, but everybody is completely and utterly bought into this. Even people who said, oh, I'm going to go away, I'm going to go on holiday, I'm going to rent my flat out. I've got friends here who didn't bother to apply for tickets and now scrambling around to get any little scraps of resales of things because they just want to be a part of it. A huge thing has become the Montgolfier balloon that has the Olympic flame underneath it. It was obviously a key part of the opening ceremony, but that is now untethered, as it were. It rises up into the sky every night at sunset and is up until 2 a.m. And people are coming out in their thousands on the street just to see this illuminated balloon. It's just an unbelievable sight. So the road race the other day as well, the cycling road race. I will tell you one very quick anecdote, not from going to one of the events, but I was just walking down to the supermarket the other day, and at the bottom of our street it was one of the roads they were going to close off for the road race, and I came across Mongolia's single representative in the road race and the time trial. He's obviously got no technical backup at all. He's just got a bike and he was just wearing his team colors. I had to look him up, and he just paused for he was out riding the Olympic road race course on his own, no backup, nothing, just pausing for a little bit just by the cafe at the bottom of our road. And that to me kind of sums up the Olympics, is that you get these huge teams. The French have got 600 odd athletes, the Great Britain has sent a lot of people, the Americans, the Chinese, and then you get this lone Mongolian cyclist who was 27th in the Olympic time trial, having competed in virtually nothing, just off having a ride around the road race with all the roads still open, in amongst the traffic, and just 5 minutes from where I live. So it's a very, very happy atmosphere, and I feel sure that the come down at the end of it, where people go back to work and realise that that there's gridlock in the Assemblée Nationale or whatever, will be quite harsh, but it's a fantastic summer at the moment.
It reminds me exactly of the build-up to London 2012, when the Evening Standard was full for weeks with their dire predictions of chaos and what a shambles it was going to be, and everyone thought it was the most diabolical use of money imaginable. And then what happened? It starts and everyone immediately buys into this wonderful atmosphere, this sense of camaraderie and achievement. Just one last comment on the Olympics, of course, Scott. It's an equestrian theme studded through it, beginning with its remarkable opening ceremony under a very unseasonable two-hour downpour in the centre of Paris.
Yeah, the metallic horse and the mystery cavalier who were sped along the Seine. It took a year to build the submarine trimaran that carried her along, and actually the rider turned out to be one of the engineers who designed this mechanical horse, which is actually slightly bigger than life size. It's 1.80 meters, I think, and it was an astonishing sight, not least because when you see other people who have nothing to do with horses representing horses, they tend to give them really weird actions. They look like some sort of arcade game. And this, they clearly really studied the movement of a horse in motion, of a horse galloping. And it was just an extraordinary sight. The same firm also actually built the cauldron as well. So they had a nervous 10 minutes or so, but speeding along the Seine and then by a trick of the camera, transforming into a real life rider and a horse who led all 205 flag bearers up the concourse at Trocadero before they raised the Olympic flag. I think, unfortunately, they raised it the wrong way up, but you know, you can't get everything right. It's an opening ceremony which seems to have divided quite a lot of opinion in reading the British media, but the public opinion poll here gave it a 96% approval rating, which in a country where most people can't even decide what cheese to have before their dessert, you know, you'd get a disagreement if you've got three people over that, is an extraordinary thing. And I think Thomas Joly and the people who designed that opening ceremony, and quite a lot of the ceremonials that have gone around the events themselves, really deserve huge plaudits, because they dreamt big. And, you know, if 9 out of 10 things you try come off, it'll look spectacular. And the metallic horse was it brought a lump to my throat anyway.
It certainly was a spectacular conclusion to the opening ceremony. We will be back in just a second after another very quick commercial break. Hello. We are going to conclude today with a preview of a series we're running this week in the Racing Post. It's called The Generation Game, and it involves several of our writers taking a group of similarly aged individuals to a day at the races to understand how different generations think about racing. And very fortunately, in the studio today, definitely on purpose, we are representing three different generations. We've got Matt here, who is a very youthful looking 25, fair play to you. You represent, therefore, Gen Z, correct?
Gen Z, yeah. 25, feeling 45 at the moment. My achy body from cricket at the weekend, but yeah, Gen Z.
Oh, just you wait,
I know, it's going to come, it's going to get worse and worse from here, isn't it?
Well, that's it. And I'm 37, so I am bang in the millennial world. And Scott, you are Gen X, the one everyone forgets.
That is exactly the one everybody forgets, exactly the one that gets lost between millennials and baby boomers. But yes, I'm 54, full disclosure.
So there we go. We're not representing the baby boomers, but the baby boomers are represented in our series. In fact, they're the first ones that piece will be live on Monday evening online and in Tuesday's newspaper. What we are trying to learn through this series is how different generations think about racing and indeed consuming sport more generally. One of the most sort of obvious things is just the way we consume media has changed significantly through generations. If you look at, for example, minutes of TV watched per week. It just goes down by cohort. I think it's fair to say, sort of, if you're Gen Z, your tendency is to have a very sort of wide range of interest, to consume media through many different sources, much less likely to sit down in front of the TV for several hours, much more likely to be streaming on social and to be picking up things from all over the world and from creators of all sorts, which means that something like racing is in a much more crowded and competitive space. Is that a fair summary, or am I showing my age and embarrassing myself as I try to interpret what Gen Z does?
Just about, but for strict purposes, I don't do any of the influencer stuff, just for me, because I'm probably a bit grumpy at heart as well. But I get what you're saying in a way. A lot of my racing stuff is consumed by social media and stuff now as well, and digital media, obviously, on the Racing Post app being one of them, but also on Twitter, X as it is now, sorry, Facebook. If I'm out and about, I might not be in for the feature race, the Stewards' Cup. I wasn't watching the Stewards' Cup on Saturday because I was out and about, but I will just go quickly onto social media and watch the clip of the final two furlongs of the race. I think that's just how everyone seems to be busy these days and on their phones and wants to consume something quickly, really, really quickly, like rapidly quick, and might not have the patience or the time to watch ITV Racing for 2 hours on a Saturday.
And that's one of the things. There was a very interesting report put out by Sky actually recently, obviously with a slightly vested interest in this, but they were looking at how different generations consume sport, and there's a massive drop off in the amount of live games watched in younger generations. And needless to say, if someone is watching a live game, they're definitely doing something else at the same time, unless it's a sort of World Cup final or something like that.
Yeah.
You know, it's just, I think we're probably all suffering a touch of ADHD as we are bombarded from all sides with options and entertainment and opportunities for us to be briefly captivated by some new thing. And it just means the older approach of sort of sitting down for 2 or 3 hours to consume from start to finish a sporting spectacle with your attention firmly fixed in it, it's just becoming slightly rare these days.
Rare, and it's probably something that's going to be quite difficult for racing, given that the sport is on being a day out, really. Especially for the Generation Z, I'm a bit of an anomaly, obviously. I'm sure there's many others that I got into sport for a quiet day at Wolverhampton on the all weather. That was just me, though. But the others, people want to go there for a day, but they'll be want to do other things at the same time, whether it be bet, have a drink. A lot of the time it's live music now as well, which I do think is a positive, despite other people having sort of protestations against it in the sport. So racing's competing and it'll be a very crowded market within that one. You know, a lot of people won't have the patience to. In cricket either, we've seen that there's now the ludicrous 100 ball competition because people don't have the time frame to sit watching 15 minutes more of cricket. But that's what racing's got to try and get through to now. And it's going to be in the era of social media and this rapid thing. People want stuff coming from left, right, centre, forward, back, wherever you want to get it from, and then move on very, very quickly within the next 5 minutes. So that's the question racing's got to ask itself. Where the answer is, I don't know. Possibly it's through influencers and stuff. There's a lot more of it these days on track. Whether they're hitting the right notes, I don't think so, in terms of the product. We've got brilliant horses in front of us. Showcase them as much as you possibly can, as Champions Full Gallop has done with the characters Human and Equine, which is great. And I have to say it was great that there was racing TV coverage on ITVX last week as well as part of the three trials. I think that's key, not only to get new fans in, but for keeping accessibility for other generations as well, those who might not have a subscription to racing TV, but they're now given the opportunity to watch the coverage on ITVX if they've got an ITVX account. It's great in that way. It could bring all generations together. Maybe it could help with subscriptions in time for racing TV, but it's putting the proper product out there rather than a fabricated product in a way. And it'll be interesting to see how that trial goes in terms of numbers.
Yeah, and Scott, I remember probably the most exciting day of my childhood, it's quite a tragic thing to say, was when the man came round to set the TV up so it could get Channel 5. yeah, with, at the risk of sounding like Rishi Sunak, we didn't have Sky TV when I was growing up. But genuinely, like, you, it's so easy to forget how limited entertainment options were for most people not that long ago. You know, and the same would apply in a sort of TV and sporting sense to betting as well. You know, you didn't have mobile apps and in betting shops, the sort of range of bets and sports you could bet on was very limited. So, you know, there's been a huge sort of change over the generations just in terms of choice.
There has. I was reminded, I did an interview with Professor David Forrest a few months ago, who was the author of, co-author of a very influential document, which I think sent shivers through the corridors of power about how racing's demographic is aging, and you know, the newer generations that come through bet on almost anything else other than horse racing, that it really does decline, and that there isn't a kind of what he called a Radio 4 effect, whereby people don't listen to it when they're younger, but they hit the age of 50 or whatever, and they suddenly think that it's vital they start listening to the Today program. He said racing doesn't really have that. I mean, if I can take you back to, we are talking about colour television here, by the way, but if I can take you back to when I first got into the sport, you would watch Grandstand on the BBC and World of Sport on ITV, and there was very, very little of those two shows that was live apart from the horse racing. I mean, it's extraordinary to think now that on a Saturday in early February, you might get the ITV7 from wherever, I don't know, I'm trying to think which were the ITV tracks in those days during the jump racing, but an ITV7 interspersed with highlights of the Super Bowl that had taken place 6 days earlier, and almost nobody who was watching it knew what the result was, other than the fact that the Pittsburgh Steelers won all the Super Bowls when I was a kid. But that has changed beyond recognition. I think in terms of a day at the races, the thing that kind of surprises me now, and I'm not sure this is so much of a generational thing, I think this might be, you mentioned ADHD, I think this is partly generational and partly a change of behavior either side of COVID, but any event I go to now, just how short people's attention is and how much people get up and down and go and do other things. I noticed this at the Olympic rowing last week, but I went to the French Open tennis the first year after COVID, and we had tickets on the centre court there, Philippe Chatrier, and there was almost nobody sat next to us for more than about half an hour. People would come in, watch two or three games, not even a whole set, two or three games, take some selfies, take some photos, and then go off and do something else, and you might not see them again for another 3 hours for a ticket that had cost well over €100. Mm. So in some senses, racing's quite well positioned for that, because certainly during the summer, when you're talking about flat racing, you're talking about sort of action points that last somewhere between a minute for a sprint and maybe 2.5 minutes for a mile and a half race or whatever. Even during the winter for jump racing, you're not very often going over about 6 minutes, and then there's 45 or 35 minutes to go and do something else. So it can work in that sense. But it is just that fight for attention and getting eyeballs on something, and there are so many alternatives going on. I'm just, you know, as I say, it, at the rowing the other day, I could not believe how much people got up and down and, you know, went to go and get food and drink or just go and have a chat with their mates or whatever. And that's a sport where there's probably 2 minutes between the end of one race and the beginning of the next, and there's 14 races all of the back of one another, and medal ceremonies and what have you thrown in there. There's never not anything going on, if you're part of the double or treble negative, and yet it's not enough for people. They're just kind of, you know, they need permanent distraction, and that's a problem for all sports. That's a, must be a problem for even for football, which, you know, last 90 minutes, that's way beyond most people's attention spans. I think if you think about how important live sports rights are to certain subscription channels, And now it would appear that actually what used to be a dirty word, highlights and really short highlights, are actually where it's at, then I think it's a problem for all sports. But as I say, racing has the opportunity because you're dealing with short bursts of activity. I mean, if like Matt was saying, you watch the last two furlongs of the Stewards' Cup, there's a chance you missed something important at the start. But you'll have got the sense and the flavour of what's happened. You'll know what's won and all the rest of it. And you've probably burnt 30 seconds doing it. And there's not that many other sports where you can really know what's happened in 30 seconds.
Yeah, definitely. And one of the other interesting things in this Sky research that I read last week was that while the number of people watching live footage has declined in younger generations, those same younger generations are actually consuming more sports media than older generations, because they are looking on social media clips, they are watching shows, podcasts and shows a bit like this, sort of covering the sports. They're consuming news and gossip and opinion. So people's way of interacting is evolving. It's becoming a bit more diffuse. It's becoming a little bit more sort of, bite-sized, because people don't really have their attention span necessarily for longer engagement stretches. But people are still engaging with sport. They're just changing the way they do it.
Yeah, absolutely. Golf is another thing I follow, and the PGA Tour viewing figures are through the floor this year, and all four majors were through the floor. And the authorities in America have started, Nielsen and the company that have for years and years and years done viewing figures, and they've started adding streaming figures, social downloads, anything they can, not just to massage the figures, but actually to try and give value to the contract. NBC has some of the contracts at the moment, CBS has some of it. When it comes to renegotiating it, those sports need to demonstrate that they still have a reach. And the same will be true when various racing contracts come up. Even going back to a previous conversation, the idea of what bookmakers pay for media rights to stream into their shops, as well as on phones and what have you. That granular detail of how people consume it is really, really important in a commercial sense. And again, I do think that even if betting on horse racing is a declining share of the pie of overall betting, I think, as I say, something which is punctual and periodical and by its very nature short, really, it's almost designed to work for generations with shorter attention spans. And so, you know, it's just a case of coming up with a way of consuming product, a kind of a business model, if you like, that works for people.
Speaking of punctual and short, we probably ought to wrap it up there because we've shot through the usual half hour segment for this. So we will indeed close there. Matt, many thanks for joining us today and for your observations on Host of Stories. Scott, likewise, thank you very much. You're going to sprint back to Paris now and enjoy some more of that fabulous Olympics atmosphere. And thank you very much to you at home for joining us. Please do stay tuned to the Racing Post through the week, including on our YouTube channel, where we will have one last plug for the big kickoff. We will have the video accompaniment for that going live pretty soon. Indeed, they're filming it just after us. So thanks again for your attention, for your time. Have a great week, and we will see you again next time.